Welcome to the Passionate Pursuit of Pedagogical Perfection podcast, episode 2, Plugging Students In. I'm your host, Aaron Daffern. Today I want to share with you a few experiences I had when I was a principal a few years ago that really shaped what I thought about education and really shed light on an area that up to that point I hadn't really considered. When I first became a new principal, I wanted to be the best principal I could be. And so I decided that rather than dealing with textbooks and discipline as much as possible, I really wanted to be in the classroom. I wanted to be an instructional leader. I wanted to help my teachers grow in their craft. And as I was observing teachers and looking at various lessons, I noticed something. I noticed that when I was viewing just the teachers, when I was looking at their lesson preparation, when I was looking at the resources they were using, even their hooks and their processing activities, I noticed that for the most part, most of my teachers were very adequate. They were doing a proficient job, and yet the results were completely different. I had some teachers that were what I would call rock stars, that were really just blown it out of the water. Their test scores were great. The parents loved them. The students seemed to be just really showing a lot of growth. And I had other teachers doing pretty close to the same thing, and yet the results were completely different. There was apathy, there was boredom, there were some emails from parents, there were some general complaints, and there was, quite honestly, an increase of classroom management problems in those other teachers. And it didn't take me long as a principal to realize that I needed to spend less time observing the teachers as I did need to start observing the students. Because at the end of the day, it's not really what the teachers know, but it's what the students can prove they know that's important. The teachers wouldn't be teachers if they weren't content specialists. I wouldn't have hired them if I didn't think they could do an adequate job of corralling 22 students for 7 hours a day. And so in my effort to be an instructional leader, I was focusing on the wrong audience. I needed to focus on the students, and that's where I saw the great difference. I noticed that in the first set of teachers' classroom that were just blowing it out of the water, the students were highly engaged. They were sitting on the edge of their seats. They were active. There was just a buzz of learning and thought and ideas bouncing off each other. And yet in the second teachers' classrooms, the ones that were less effective, it was a lot quieter. More orderly, the students typically sat in rows, and they worked at their desk. The teacher either taught from her desk or in front of the room, and the students seemed a lot less into it. And it really got me thinking about what it is that really builds into the learning equation. Yes, a part of it is what we do as teachers. It's our pedagogy. It's the instructional choices we make, the textbooks we use, the questions we ask, the processing activities we design or we borrow from TPT or some other resource. But that's only half of the equation. As I was contemplating this and figuring out how I could best support my teachers, my mind went back to something that had happened about a year before this time when I was a principal that just really shed light on everything, and it brought the entire equation together. In this previous episode, had nothing to do with school. I was at my house, I was about to leave, and I had a few minutes before I needed to get out the door, and so I decided I was going to just flip the TV on real quick and catch the news, see if there's any breaking news, catch an update, you know, just read the crawl at the bottom of the screen, something. And so I picked up the remote, pointed it at the television, and nothing happened. And that really bothered me because that's one of those things you don't even consider might not work. When you put your key in your car and you turn it, you just expect the car to start. When you push the power button on the remote, you expect the TV to turn on. And when it doesn't, it shocks you. It's not something that you hope works. You just assume it's going to work. And so I did what any normal person would do, is I did the exact same thing multiple times, hoping I would get a different result. But after mashing the power button again and again and again and not getting the TV to turn on, I started to slow down and use some of my problem-solving skills. I looked at the remote, and I realized it's a multifunction remote. one of those fancy doodads that theoretically can control multiple devices, but typically never does, and you still end up with 8 different remotes. But I don't know how many times my kids have come up to me and said, "Dad, the TV's not working," or "Dad, the Blu-ray's not working." And really, it's not the remote, it's not the device, it's the fact that the remote has been pushed to try to operate the wrong device. If it's a multifunction remote, the TV button needs to be pushed, so it's trying to connect with the TV. And I figured maybe one of my kids had been messing around with the remote, you know, when in doubt, blame the kids. And they'd push the Blu-ray button, or they'd push the cable button or the auxiliary button. So, pretty sure I'd solve my problem. I pushed the TV button on the remote, pointed it at the television. Still nothing happened when I pushed the power button. I didn't give up. I have a 4-step problem-solving process. I am a professional educator, by the way. And so I decided to look at the problem again, and I realized not only is it a multifunction remote, it's a universal remote. It's not the original remote that came with the device, with the TV, because those things don't last too long in my house full of children. And so we had to buy this one at Walmart. And, you know, it's one of those deals to where you get it and it's supposed to operate anything you want to. And there's this little wadded up piece of paper in the back when you open up the package. And then you unfold the little piece of paper and there's 8 billion 4-digit codes that you need to try to enter or find in order to match up your remote with the manufacturer of the device. And I was thinking perhaps the kids didn't just push one of the wrong input buttons on the remote, but they actually deprogrammed it somehow. And so I actually went to the junk drawer in our kitchen and found that wadded up little piece of paper, which is surprising because typically I would just throw something like that away. But I found it, and I went through the entire setup process. I knew the batteries on the remote were good because I just changed them recently. And every time I pushed the button, I got a red light. So the problem wasn't the batteries on the remote. I had the piece of paper, went through the entire setup process, went pushed the setup button, got a double red blink on the diode at the end, went, found the 4-digit code that matched my remote with the television manufacturer, entered it, pressed OK, hit setup again, got a nice double red blink, which means it had accepted the code. I was pretty sure I'd solve the problem at this point. At this stage in the entire exercise, I should have been gone about 5 minutes before. I had completely missed what I was attempting to do, which was pick up some news on the television, but that really wasn't the point. By this point, I had taken it as a personal affront to my manhood that technology had defeated me, and I was going to solve this problem come hell or high water. And so, confident that I had reprogrammed the remote, everything was fine, I stood in front of the television, pushed the power button on the remote, and still nothing happened. Okay, we have some problems, because I was pretty sure the TV was broken, and if the TV is broken in the house, it is not a good thing. The only thing that is worse would be World War III, a nuclear holocaust, or the Wi-Fi going out. If it's one of those three things, it's worse. But having no TV is pretty high up there. And I didn't have the money to go out and buy a new TV. I really wanted this thing to work. And so I started doing things that made no sense, things that had no chance of working. I tried getting a little Clorox wipe and wiping off the diode on the remote and the little sensor covering on the TV, thinking maybe there are some fingerprints covering it up. I started pushing random buttons on the remote that really didn't do anything, and then pushing the power button, hoping I would just magically do it. Maybe it was an angle I was holding it at. I started holding it behind my back, between the legs. You name it. By the time my wife walked in, about 30 seconds later, I was in some weird yoga pose, mashing the power button again and again and again. And she looked at me, and obviously I looked a little strange. And she said, "Okay, hon, what's going on?" I was very upset at that point, very frustrated. It wasn't her fault, but unfortunately some of the frustration came through my voice, and I simply told her, "Hun, I don't know what's going on, but I think there's something wrong with the TV. I know we don't have the money, but we have to go out. We have to buy a TV right now because it's not working." And she looked at me. She was very calm. And her face didn't change at all, except a little twinkle in her eye. And if you are a married man, you know that Your wife can just speak volumes and paragraphs of information with just a look. And I recognized the look, and that look said to me, "You are an idiot." And I didn't quite understand, but I was started to get a little bit hopeful. Very calm, very serenely, she said, "I'm so sorry, hon. This is my fault. I was in here earlier, and I was vacuuming. I needed the outlet for the vacuum cleaner, and I guess I forgot to plug the TV back in." She walked over, plugged the TV back in, the thing popped right on. I was completely floored. At that point, I was just happy that I did not have to go out and buy a new television. That was a common joke in our household for years and years and years. Ha ha ha, remember that time I thought the TV was broken? But going back to the original scenario of when I was an instructional leader on my campus, when I first became a principal, I was trying to nail down what is it that's different between the teachers that had the engaged students and the teachers who were using the exact same instructional practices but got vastly inferior results. And I realized the difference was not necessarily what the teachers were doing, but the difference was what the students were doing. You see, in the first classes, in the classrooms where the students were highly engaged and they were into the lesson and they were making connections, they were making meaning, they were plugged in. For whatever reason, they bought into whatever that teacher was teaching them that day. And they took ownership of their learning, and their engagement was active, and they were making meaning, they were thinking critically. Yet in the other classrooms, the second classrooms that were having inferior results, those students were unplugged. They were disengaged. And the teacher said everything correctly. The teacher had all the right activities. The teacher knew what she was talking about. But the students were unplugged. And no matter what that teacher did, no matter how many codes she tried to enter into her remote control, standing up in front of that class, desperately trying to get the students turned on to learning, it wasn't going to happen because they were disengaged. They were unplugged. And it was reflecting on that that I realized that learning is two parts. Learning is one part instructional design. That's what we do as educators. We are professional educators. That's what our degrees are in. That's what our certification, our experience has taught us to do. We know how to design instruction. But the second part, it has to do with the student. The student has to be engaged. If the student is not plugged into learning, no matter what you do, no matter which buttons you push, it's not going to work. And so when those two things meet, when you have instructional design and students that are motivated, when they are bought into the learning, when they want to grow their knowledge, that's when engagement happens. And that aha moment, it was good, but it also left me with more questions than I started with. I knew what good instruction looked like. I knew the foundations of curriculum design and how to design a unit and quality assessments and rigorous questions and all of that. Years and years of experience, professional development, books, book studies, professional learning communities, we know how to design good curriculum. But what I felt like we didn't know at our school, and what I came to find out in education in general, is we didn't know what the other half of the equation was made of. We didn't know what motivated students, what plugged them in. Why did they learn? Why do they come to school? Why do they sometimes decide to engage in instruction and then sometimes they completely blow it off? Why can one lesson work for 3/4 of the class but not for the other 25%? What is it that gets students plugged into learning? That was what I was left wondering. Because if we knew what motivated students, if we knew what it was that got them plugged in, well, then we can incorporate that into our instructional design. And rather than hoping and praying that your lesson goes off well and that your students will be interested, if you design instruction specifically to motivate students, if you leverage what they naturally want into your lesson, you can guarantee engagement. You can make sure your students are plugged in all the time because you specifically incorporate student motivation into your instructional design in order to get them plugged in. That will be the topic of many future podcasts. If you are interested in learning more right now, you can go to my website, aarondaffron.com. I've actually written two separate books about student motivation and engagement. I'm also a frequent blogger, and I have many posts about what we will talk about in future podcasts, the five facets of student motivation. And I also train schools and districts around the country in student engagement and motivation techniques. I hope you enjoyed this second episode of the Passionate Pursuit of Pedagogical Perfection podcast. And remember, never stop improving.